This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We are facing traumas. We may have to face more trauma in order to get there. But the soft landing comes if we reorient ourselves to how do we be good ancestors for future generations? How do we be good stewards of this incredible thing called life on Earth that we've been given? So that's the moral and ethical aspect. It's our job to look after the future.
This week on Sea Change Radio, we focus on southern New England and how climate change is affecting the region. We hear from Frank Carini, the co-founder of EcoRI, a publication which recently came out with a special report on the topic. We discuss the often overlooked issue of rising incidents of Lyme disease in the region and how they're connected to the warming atmosphere, how the livelihoods of local fishermen are being affected by changing oceans, and what cities like Providence, Rhode Island are doing to offset rising temps. Then we revisit our 2017 discussion with Mission Venture capitalist Joel Solomon as he expounds on the future of our collective economic well-being. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Frank Carini. He's the editor and co-founder of EcoRI News. Frank, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Glad to be here.
So EcoRI News has a special report I wanted to dive into. It's called Climate Change in Southern New England. First, why don't you give us the genesis of the project? It's a good overview of many examples of how climate change is affecting your region.
Yeah, we just wanted to do a comprehensive story or look at, you know, how climate change, it's not just sea level rise or more rain or more snow or whatever. It's a complicated problem that deals with the economy, it deals with public health, it deals with social justice. So we wanted to do, and we cover this ongoing, but we wanted to do the series as a way to just, it's all in one spot if somebody wanted to see all the stories in one spot. So there's 1 week reading about this. And then if they don't want to connect the dots or if they're not longtime readers and they're just hitting us every once in a while, they can give you a vague idea, not a vague idea, a good idea of how climate change, global warming, overpopulation, whatever you want to call it, is affecting southern New England. And not just, you know, coastal erosion, but, you know, it's affecting the, you know, inner cities, the low, you know, low income parts of the area and stuff like that. It affects a wide swath of the community. It affects everyone.
I want to hit upon some of the areas that we haven't really covered too much on Sea Change Radio. One I hadn't really thought of would be affected by climate change, and that's the uptick of Lyme disease. There are more ticks now in southern New England than before, or is it just that more ticks are carrying Lyme disease? Why don't you break down that issue for us if you can?
It's a little bit of both, but basically the climate's changing where it's making ticks, tick season is longer, starts earlier, and it's just a better breeding ground, a better environment for ticks, the way that the southern New England, at least anyways, climate is changing, just the seasons are changing. You know, they're kind of spring and fall are kind of merging into one, if you will. It seems like it's just a changing of the climate, just changing everything, and it's putting everything into chaos. And the tick season just lasting longer, and it's not getting as cold for as long. So they're surviving through that. More of them are surviving through that. So more of them are, when spring does arrive, there's more of them there because the winter hasn't been a long enough cold spells to kill them off.
And it sounds like the malady, as you reference in one of the pieces, is that Rhode Island, your state, has the fourth highest rate of Lyme disease in the country per capita, but Maine, Vermont, and Massachusetts are in the top three. So these ticks are moving north as these northern states are warming. Is that fair to assume?
Yeah. Yeah, the climate's changing as, you know, it's getting warmer. I mean, way up in, you know, northern Maine, there's probably not as big a problem, but southern Maine and Vermont, it's getting warmer there. It's a fact. So the ticks are slowly, they're lasting longer, or lasting through the winter, more of them, and their range is expanding because the weather's warming, or the climate's warming, I should say.
And this is not just ticks and Lyme disease. There's also West Nile and equine encephalitis and other type of diseases that are affected by extreme weather changes, right?
Yeah, those are mosquito-carrying diseases. And yes, there's more rainwater. There's more intense rain. So now rainwater or puddles, ponds, you know, are staying wet longer, so more mosquitoes are being bred, and the same thing's happening. When I was a kid, I grew up in Massachusetts, and now I live in Rhode Island, but there wasn't as much of, you didn't hear about it this as much, maybe because it wasn't publicized as much, or maybe it's because it wasn't such as big a concern, probably a little bit of both, but there's certainly, mosquito breeding season is being helped by it being wet here in southern New England.
So I have a friend who lives in Nantucket who's a deer hunter, and I've enjoyed his venison over the years quite a bit. One of the responses to this uptick in ticks is to try to cull the deer population. I know in Block Island, for example, they were paying $150 per deer kill during a special hunt. But is that really an effective way to try to cut back on Lyme disease, or are there other reasons for trying to cull the deer population?
I think there's other, no, I mean, they're called deer ticks, but actually mice, field mice carry are more of a problem than if you were going to, who's carrying deer ticks, the more field mice are carrying more of the deer ticks than the deers. They just have that name. But, you know, culling the deer population is important. I mean, it would help with that somewhat, but it also helped the ecosystem because deer will just keep, you know, reproducing, and then the ecosystem, they're eating all the vegetation, they're stomping all over everything. So it does make sense to keep the population, much like humans. Not that I'm saying cull the human population, but yeah, anytime you get too many of one species in a, you know, especially on Block Island or Nantucket, you know, it can cause a lot of damage. And it also would help mildly with the deer tick problem. But like I said, a lot of deer tick is mice, field mice are a bigger problem carrying them around.
Yes, you quote a Harvard researcher from a 2010 interview, Tamara Auerbach, who says, quote, "If you kill deer, you would simply have more ticks per deer because the surface area of each is enough to support many ticks. Just killing deer won't do the job."
No, that won't do anything. I mean, it would help, like I said, the ecosystem's health, but it's not really going to really effectively or do much with the Lyme disease.
Lyme disease is much more well known than it was 10, 20 years ago, but are there any cures on the horizon for it, or are we just trying to control it at this point?
It controlled. There's actually a neighbor here who had it before we moved in. He almost died. Apparently, he was just telling me the story the other day. He got it, you know, it wasn't diagnosed because it was kind of before the how it is in the media now and how everybody's attention. But he almost died. But never. It's always in your system and it could come out again. So you got to keep an eye on it. So there's no cure per se. But if you can catch it early enough, they can deal with it pretty effectively.
So let's move to the ocean. And although Rhode Island is not an island, it is largely dependent on its fishing and other ocean-related activities, tourism, beaches. It's a small state and it's a fragile economy that's largely dependent on a fragile ecosystem. It's not a hugely industrial state, right?
No.
So why don't you outline some of the challenges that the fishing community is encountering right now because of climate change in Rhode Island?
Well, the biggest challenge is simply that the water temperature is going up in the bay 1 or 2 degrees in the last 50 years, and it's going up, and actually that's changing the biomass of the bay. So things that are winter flounder have long disappeared. There's hardly any lobster. So a lot of these popular species that fishermen here for decades, generations grew up catching and learned about, they've moved out, and other biomass, kind of like Chesapeake Bay species, if you will, are moving in. So this kind of in a state of flux now. You know, cod was wiped out a long time ago. So there's just a different biomass, and some fishermen have complained that they think the bay is too clean. It is cleaner than it was 40 or 50 years ago. That's why the fish are leaving, but that's not the problem that it's too clean. It's the fact that the water temperature is changing and warming up, and the species that like the colder water are moving northward.
Too clean. I'd never heard that as an accusation.
Yeah, and they're just frustrated, and that's, you know, some have said that, but that's not the reason. It's simple climate change, and the bay's water is warming.
And also it's becoming acidified in some areas as well, isn't it?
Well, the sea is, I don't know, they haven't really done any studies about Narragansett Bay, the acidity in that. I don't know if that's, that is happening worldwide. So yes, that's probably part of it too, but it's mainly, at least from the studies that have been done at URI, we have a lot of great research institutes here and academia regarding climate change and so forth. And the biggest thing is warming water temperatures.
Well, a lot of the studies are empirical in terms of the relationship between the shellfish populations and acidification, right? And shellfish is not nearly as abundant in Rhode Island as it once was.
No, that's more of the changes in, just basically overshellfished, if you will, back in the day. It used to be a huge hotbed. It's slowly getting back. It's basically recreating, and a lot of it's been trawled, so a lot of that habitat was destroyed, so they're trying to build that back up with artificial reefs for oysters, and a lot of aquaculture here, and there's very few scallops, and they're trying to get that back. So yes, it was a part of it is climate pressures, and part of it is, you know, overfished, you know, years ago, and bringing back the habitat.
I mean, just looking at lobster hauls, you cite 1998 Connecticut's lobster catch, and this is all the same, just for listeners around the country. Connecticut and Rhode Island both abut the Long Island Sound and that same ocean. Connecticut's lobster catch hit a record 3.7 million pounds in 1998. By 2013, the lobster catch was 121,000 pounds.
Yep.
So it's just pretty much, it's gone from a very healthy industry to almost zero.
Yeah, and same with Rhode Island. Mass, not as bad, but pretty bad. A lot of it's moving to Maine, and then even some of the Maine lobstermen. We don't cover Maine; we only cover the, you know, southern New England. But they're moving up. They're moving up the coast, and pretty soon they'll all be in Canada. But yeah, the lobsters have disappeared, and it you know, some people would argue that's also from overfishing. That might have been, plays a part of it, maybe, but it is because the waters are warming and the habitat's changing.
I'm just not made for the heat. This is my first summer in New York, and it's practically killing me.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Frank Carini. He's the editor and co-founder of EcoRI News. So Frank, let's talk about more direct effects of climate change, the way people are affected by the heat and how it affects allergies and breathing. Maybe you can summarize a piece that your organization wrote in EcoRI News called Climate Planning, The Heat Is On. How are people preparing differently for climate change in your estimation?
Well, in southern New England, you know, we harp on, you know, we got to have cooling centers, and during the summer the heat's rising, and that's well and good, and we have that. But it's I don't think in Rhode Island or southern New England in general, we're not doing enough to, I mean, we planting some trees in the cities and having the cooling centers, that's not enough. Where the heat island effect is big, you know, you have Boston, Providence, there's a lot of urban density in eastern Mass, in Rhode Island, or at least eastern Rhode Island, Connecticut along the coast, and in Hartford and everything. There's such a concrete jungle that with climate change, the atmosphere, and this region's already getting warmer, then with all our asphalt and impervious surfaces and less vegetation, it's getting hotter. And we need to be more than just put some air conditioners in some senior centers. It takes more than that. And we're cutting, at least in Rhode Island specifically, cutting down more and more trees all the time. And then we plant a handful here or we plant a handful there. We have to do, we don't, our, we have tools and we have plans, but we don't really follow them, at least here in Rhode Island. That's the biggest problem.
Yeah, so a 2014 survey of municipal health department heads across Massachusetts revealed a startling lack of attention in the changing climate. You write, consider 60% expected climate impacts, 69% said preparation to address the health effects wasn't a priority. 21% they have the resources to address the health issues of climate change. 62% said they didn't have the expertise and would require staff and funds to address climate change. So that data tells me that from a management level perspective, there isn't enough buy-in and preparing for the reality of climate change.
Yeah, that's the problem. There's a lot of tools, there's tons of studies. Rhode Island has volumes and volumes of studies that have been done on climate change and environmental protection. Same with Rhode Island, same with Connecticut. But a lot of times, especially in Rhode Island, they ignore the plans or what should be done development wise or climate change wise for special interests and big money. And we don't do what we're supposed to do. Like I was talking about before, we're cutting down trees to build casinos, cutting down trees to build a natural gas fossil fuel power plant in one of the biggest continuous forests in Northwest Rhode Island. You know, we don't follow the plans that are given unless they're like, you know, somebody wants to build wants to make an addition to their porch and it's in a wetland area. We'll deny the person that, and rightfully so, but we don't follow the rules when we're saying, let's keep all our growth to urban centers. We're not doing that. We're cutting down forests for casinos and office parks in the woods in Johnston. We're not paying attention to what the climate's telling us and how important environmental protections are. It's a big problem.
There are people working to try to solve the problem. Why don't you outline a little bit about the Providence Neighborhood Planting Program, which is trying to, it's a tree planting campaign. Has that been a success to some degree?
Yeah, that's been a success. And we have that's a small neighborhood group that's planting street trees in Providence, which is important.
I see.
And we have awesome, the University of Rhode Island, the Coastal Institute, the School of Oceanography down at URI, Brown University, we have the Coastal Resource Management Council, have created tools like storm tools, which is a way to track sea level rise. And we have all these great tools that give you information about climate change. And they're nationally looked at. But like I said, we're creating them. We have scientists here. We have the academia here. But we're not really listening to it. So we're like that, like you mentioned, the Providence tree planting. So they're busting their butts just to raise money to plant some trees here and there. And we're going down in one fell swoop and cutting down, 40,000 trees to put in solar panels. Solar panels are great. They're renewable energy, but we're putting them in forests. We're cutting down trees to put them in when we have all this developed open space, if you will, parking lots, vacant big box stores that we could be putting solar panels on, or what do they call the solar canopies for parking lots. But we're not doing that. We're cutting down trees to put in solar panels. We're not paying attention to the tools we're given and the people that we have here that are speaking out about the things that need to be done to really address climate change. It takes sacrifice. We're not doing that.
I forgot about this little tidbit that I read in one of your pieces on this in this special report, Frank. And you quote in this piece that, quote, a NASA study of 42 cities in the Northeast found that Providence has one of the highest heat island temperature disparities. As a densely built metropolis, Providence is more than 12 degrees warmer in summer than the surrounding geography. That's pretty stunning.
Yeah, there's no Central Park like in New York. Boston, where I lived for many years, has many more trees and many more green spaces, and that's a huge problem. I mean, we have like we're talking about the street trees. That's a big problem. And a lot of the trees, and this isn't unique to Providence, but a lot of the trees that were planted in Providence back in the day were, I forgot the name in the variety, but they're easily blown down by severe winds, which is a problem here. So we've lost them. And we just don't, Boston, where I lived for many years, also has more green space and more open space and more trees. Providence has a stunning lack of it. Having lived there for 12 years, there is not a lot of trees in Providence. And that's why you get those temperature rises.
Well, it's important work that you and your colleagues are doing at EcoRI News to try to give people a better idea of how the region is being affected. I highly recommend people go to ecori.org to check it out. Frank Carini, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. Appreciate it.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Joel Solomon. He is a mission venture capitalist. His new book is called The Clean Money Revolution. Joel, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So first, what is a mission venture capitalist?
That's our best way to demonstrate a difference from traditional venture capital. And that difference is that first is about the mission of the company and is it going to do something that's constructive to the future well-being of people and places. And so we're similar to other early growth stage investors, but our focus is on organic food, organic skincare, and environmental technologies, which inherently puts us into sectors that both are helping make the world better in one way or another, and secondly, which are in large growth and a lot of demand right now, so we can do a good job making money for our investors while we invest that way.
Now, I want to dive into all the forms of green investing in a second. They go by lots of different names, from SRI to ESG to impact investing. But first, explain to us how the U.S. stock market just keeps going up and up in the face of some real tumultuous times. Why is Wall Street responding like having Donald Trump as our president is business as usual?
Well, first I'll say I've been privileged not to have to go into the stock market because I'm a private investor in private companies as well as with real estate and other things. I'm able to be an entrepreneur. So that was a choice I made a long time ago. However, I get affected by it and everybody else does. How this is happening right now looks like insanity to me. There are all kinds of reasons that it shouldn't, and there are all kinds of reasons to be very concerned about the future of the economy. Seems like we're on the edge of a very big bubble. And it's the time, of course, when people then want to buy. It's just like housing prices. Everybody feels it's an endless gold rush and they should get in. So I'm very nervous about the next crash and what it does in combination with where the world has gone on climate and equity and all kinds of issues that put us in a very tenuous place right now, is my point of view.
So with that in mind, there's going to be a lot of money coming out of the market and into other places. And part of your thesis in Clean Money Revolution is that with the baby boomers passing away, there will be $50 trillion worth of wealth being passed on to millennials. What do you see their mandate being? And what is the vision that an impact investor like yourself is trying to set forth how this next generation should invest its money?
Yes, they're all getting much wealthier in the future right now if the markets and real estate and all that hold. The hope is, and we have to have some hope, that millennials have grown up in an era where technology and information has become much, much more accessible. So there's more transparency and insight into what's going on. If you purchase, like, you take your cell phone. I love my cell phone. It's attached to my body, basically. I almost want to sleep with it. Can't help it. What's it made of? Some of the things that go into making that cell phone are doing severe damage, heavy-duty ecological damage, and severe damage to people. We don't think about that. We carry on. We get the next model. We know that where the waste of cell phone goes is also a kind of dramatic issue. Okay, well, we can look at that throughout society. I lived through an era where you didn't really have to think about or know those things when you bought something or when you invested in a company. However, we now can know more. So my premise is that, as happened to me in my younger years and then carried on to be my career, is that once you start to understand the other side of where the money that's sitting in your pocket or your credit card or your bank account or your stock fund, your mutual funds, your retirement funds, what that's actually doing to people and places, and you know that, and you start to see that there's alternatives. First, you get aggravated by the fact that you're actually participating in very damaging and destructive activities in order to do the natural thing, which is to take care of your family, look out for your old age, and send your kids to school and that kind of thing, which is a natural human instinct. But the result is you want something better if you can have it. And so with the rise of things like organic food movement, renewable energy, green buildings, you go through the entire economy and you're seeing these reforms, less wasteful, more efficient, more long-term, less damaging to people, less damaging to ecology. There's opportunity to make choices so that your money shifts from out-and-out damaging and destructive practices to hopefully at least softer, less damaging ones. But ideally now, we can actually turn around entire industries. And so we hope and we're counting on these next generations to be smarter than we have, at least better informed, and because of that, make better choices.
You write about the moral or ethical call to action in your book. Can you give us an example?
Well, I think the role of global world religions was to give us some spiritual guidance and to help us understand the meaning of life. I think that's where they came from. We're confused. How did we get here? Who are the gods? You know, how does this all work? Well, they also have a reinvention to go through. And I think of something as simple as the golden rule. Am I with my money doing unto others as I would like to be done to? Not very often. So I actually think this is a spiritual evolution, if not revolution, that's required, which we may have to face trauma, and we are facing traumas. We may have to face more trauma in order to get there. But the soft landing comes if we reorient ourselves to how do we be good ancestors for future generations? How do we be good stewards of this incredible thing called life on Earth that we've been given? So that's the moral and ethical aspect. It's our job to look after the future.
His book is Clean Money Revolution, Reinventing Power, Purpose, and Capitalism, Joel Solomon. Joel, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's been a pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by John Coltrane, Prince Buster, and The Meters. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.